What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Barely Legal in Web3. I'm your host, Jamelia Greer, bringing you the latest in Web3 every week with a legal twist. So hold on to your digital wallets and let's get into it. Welcome back to another episode of Barely Legal in Web3. A little over a week ago, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission approved the listing and the trading of a number of spot Bitcoin ETPs, or as we normally think of them, ETFs, exchange-traded funds. The approval itself sent shockwaves through the crypto and the greater Web3 space. I think the approval was something that people were really waiting for a very long time. I had the pleasure to sit down and have a conversation with SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce, not just about the Bitcoin ETF approval, but about the greater challenges of creating a regulatory framework for digital assets, specifically for crypto, and her thoughts on how the world is tackling this problem, and really what she'd like to see happen moving forward. Here's my conversation with Commissioner Peirce.
A pleasure to have you on. It's a pleasure to get to speak to you today.
Well, likewise. Great to talk to you.
Great. And, you know, I always like to kick it off and kind of get down to the crux of the issue, which is the motivations for why someone ended up in the career that they're in, and to really understand a bit more about the career path. And so curious, what led you to really pursue a career in financial regulation?
Well, first, let me start out by giving you my disclaimer, which is that my views are my own views as a commissioner and not necessarily those of the SEC or my fellow commissioners. And I wish I had a great story of, you know, an epiphany that I needed to be a financial regulator, but it was much more random than that. It was really about marrying a couple of things that I'm interested in. So I majored in economics undergrad, and then I went to law school, and securities law is a nice intersection of the two. And then once, so I ended up at the SEC very early in my career because it's really good to be at the regulator if you're going to be practicing in a regulatory area. You get the inside view. And then after having been at the SEC for a while and then spending some time on Capitol Hill, which enabled me to view things through the eyes of Congress, where they tell agencies what to do. It gives you a real appreciation for the importance of listening to Congress when they tell you what to do and not going off and doing something different. But it also, because I was up on Capitol Hill during the financial crisis and then the aftermath, it gave me a real chance to think about what works in financial regulation and what doesn't. Financial regulation can be very helpful, or it can actually cause problems. And so that led me then to go and take an academic view of sort of financial regulation. How do you do it well? How do you think about the economic analysis behind financial regulation? And so I did that working with a lot of economists and other lawyers as well. And then that led me back to the SEC in the capacity where I am now.
That's amazing. It's so interesting to hear how it was really a marrying of different interests that you had from economics and law and now at financial regulation. And, you know, for me, I have a similar background in economics and law. And although I'm not in the U.S., based outside of the U.S., I'm always keen to look in and keen to understand what sort of regulatory developments are happening in the U.S. And it's been so fascinating to me to see that some jurisdictions have been really quick to create new framework and to try to usher in innovation, where the U.S. has taken a different approach. What are your thoughts on this sort of seems like a gap between what the rest of the world is doing and what the U.S. has done in terms of regulating digital assets?
No, I think you're right to point out that the U.S. has taken a different approach, whether it's a studied approach that we decided we want to be a little slower because technology is moving and we don't want to get ahead of technology. I think it's more likely that we just are struggling a bit to figure out how to regulate. And meanwhile, other jurisdictions have moved ahead. I think that one advantage that we have is we can learn from what other jurisdictions do. But I think the disadvantage is that a lot of people now I hear from, and I've been at the SEC for 6 years, so I've heard this throughout my time at the SEC, but I think the chorus has gotten louder. It's just not worth building something in the U.S. or for a U.S. customer base because there's so much uncertainty about what the regulatory framework is going to be. And that makes me sad because, you know, I think there are lots of really good things about innovating in the US. We have a history of being a place where people from all over the world come to build things. And I want that to continue. And I think regulatory clarity is one piece of the framework that allows that to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about regulatory trends and economic trends. You know, we had the economic downturn, and there's always this push and pull with US and China, but also US and the rest of the world. Do you think that this sort of slow to regulate approach would have any long-lasting effects on innovation and where it decides to go?
I think it could. I mean, I do think that we should look at the global economy as, you know, we all want a rising tide lifts all boats, right? We should all be working together across national borders as well. But I certainly want the US to be the place that people come, smart people from all over the world come and build things. And so I think it does set us back when it's not only the lack of clarity, but it's also the enforcement piece that goes with that, which is that you get the clarity through enforcement actions, which, you know, feels a little bit arbitrary to people who are the subject of those actions, right? I mean, sometimes it doesn't, right? When you've got an outright fraud, you've got to be expecting to face an enforcement action at some point. But when you're just, you know, starting up a little project and you're trying to figure out how to weave through the regulatory thicket, and then you're met with an enforcement action, it can be quite discouraging.
Absolutely. And I imagine as a regulator, you probably have a wish list of things that you wish you could implement and you wish you could roll out. What would some of those things be? I mean, I always am fascinated with Singapore, where I lived for a while. And, you know, they get a rep for being a bit strict, of course, but it's effective. So curious to if you had a wish list, a Christmas list of what you'd add to the regulatory framework, what would that be?
I think it's interesting that you raise Singapore, because I do think that some of the ways in which they allow experimentation are really interesting. The regulator is involved in sort of green lighting experiments. And I think that that's something that we could do better here in the US. A lot of people talk about a sandbox, and I like the idea in general, although I don't love the idea of having the regulator sitting there watching in the every step of the way in the sandbox, because I think that does squelch creativity a little bit. But having an ability for people to come in and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do. We'll abide by these conditions because we know we've got to protect investors and foster market integrity. We don't want to undermine those important goals of the SEC, but we have a way to do this. Can you let us try on a small scale and then come back to you and report how it's going? That can be tremendously beneficial, not only to the person doing the innovation, but to us as regulators. We can learn from that. So I think that would be one piece of my sort of dream wish list of things. Another thing that I did put out a safe harbor for token issuances several years ago. And the idea was, let's try to get people the information we know that they would want in connection with a token offering, but at the same time, not expect a company that is, or a project that is a tiny new startup, essentially, to meet the requirements that we impose on companies going public, which are at a very different stage in their lives. And so can we walk that line where we get people the information they need, but we also don't assume that every company, every project is equivalent to a large company. Now, the other piece I would say that has changed my wish list a little bit, it's not just that I would like the SEC to do something, but I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of Congress. As I mentioned earlier on, I think it's really important for regulators to listen to Congress when Congress tells them to act. And Congress has looked at a number of ways to allocate regulatory responsibility over the crypto space. And I'll be really interested to see how those frameworks actually come out, if they come out, when they come out, and what they look like.
It's funny you mentioned Congress. it's interesting to see the different challenges that the SEC particularly is faced with in terms of building and creating the regulatory framework. Of course, the US has the three different branches that are all working in concert to build something, whereas other countries, other jurisdictions might not have that mechanism. And so to your point, there's a little bit of benefit in going slow and learning from others and maybe, you know, taking a few pages out of their book to continue to build out and take the good parts of what's working.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, we will see how, for example, MiCA plays out in Europe. It's playing out differently in different jurisdictions within Europe. So I think we'll have some nice comparisons. You want to have a framework that makes sense, that does help you to sort of keep the bad actors out and let the good actors in with reasonable rules around what they do. And so seeing how that plays out in different jurisdictions will be helpful. And then I think another piece that I'm thinking a lot about is, although I'm a financial regulator, I do have a concern that what we could end up doing is building a framework that works for financialized crypto, but not for non-financialized crypto. And I think there's a lot of interesting possibility outside of the world of finance for this technology. Again, I'm not a technologist, so maybe I'm wrong, but I don't want to ruin the other parts of it by forcing them into a financial regulatory model that doesn't make sense.
That's such an important point, because when I look at, you know, the application of things like the Howey test and the securities regulations, I'm always wondering, is that really the best, you know, the best regulation and case law to hang a hat on, seeing that the technology has so many different use cases? And we're seeing that in different ways with gaming, where there's really no financial incentive, really. It's more about utility and metaverse, but there are some tokens involved. And so can you talk a little bit about, and I think you did kind of mention it a bit, but talk a little bit about where this is kind of headed in terms of where you'd hope it would head for regulations.
Yeah, well, I think there are instances, the Howey test, I have my concerns about it just outside of crypto as well, because it is a little bit imprecise, and you know, that's the nature of case law, right? You're looking at how it fits to one set of factors that's in that case, the Howey case, and then you're trying to extrapolate to other situations and figure out whether it fits. But I think the general premise underlying Howey makes a lot of sense, right? If I sell you something along with a promise that I'm going to increase the value of it and you don't have to do any work. Okay, fine. We can say that makes sense. I think it would be nice to have something to point to, something more than statements about, you know, we're going to build a blockchain and it's going to be fantastic. Well, I mean, of course you're going to say it's going to be fantastic. Why would you say your project is going to be a failure? So I think we need to be, we need to look for more than just optimistic projections of how something is going to work to figure out whether there really is an investment contract. And then once we've decided there is an investment contract, I think we need to think about being precise, that the investment contract is the promises that were made plus the underlying object, whether that's a crypto asset or whether it's a piece of an orange grove. That doesn't change the orange grove or the crypto asset into itself a security. And I think that's really important, because we need to be precise about how long those promises continue to follow that object around. And this really is something that's new in crypto, because we have vibrant secondary markets for crypto. And that has not been the case, I think, for a lot of these other objects that have been found to be where there have been found to be investment contracts, that have been found to be at the center of an investment contract. And so that we have not, I think, as regulators, really addressed that issue very well.
Last year was really a turbulent and exciting year. And beginning of this year started off with a great kick. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But last year, we saw so many frauds and scams and negative news about crypto. And, you know, these things are valid. These things are true. But overall, why do you think it gets such a bad rep? You know, illegal activity, terrorism, all of these things are part of the world that we live in, and they exist whether or not this technology exists. Why do you think that crypto gets such a bad rep?
And I think, to be fair, there is a lot of scammy activity that is associated with, or at least is wearing the t-shirt that says crypto. Whether it actually is a whole different question, because a lot of the things that have been painted with that scammy crypto brush are actually not crypto at all. But I think, you know, people are people, and they look at whatever the hottest thing is, and they, you know, some of them do real work there, and other people just build or don't, they build a fraud scheme. And I think we need to worry about that now that AI is the hot thing. I think we need to worry about that with AI as well. And it's like anything else. You know, you have things that people will use. Some people will use them for good. Some people will use them for bad. But I think another piece of why we are where we are is, again, this lack of regulatory clarity, because it is much easier for frauds to arise in areas where there's not regulatory clarity, because then it's much harder for people to assess which of these are operating within a legal framework and which of these are not. So I think that lack of regulatory clarity is partly to blame. Now, again, the blame lies with people who try to rip other people off. That is for sure true. And I think we as regulators have an obligation, if it's within our jurisdiction, to try to address that. But the community also, I think, needs to, the legitimate crypto community needs to be pointing out to government authorities and to other people in the community when they see something that's off. And I think that should be a lesson that we draw from 2023. I think another lesson from 2023 is, you know, there are principles that apply equally to traditional finance and to crypto. And so don't forget about those principles. You know, if you're engaged in a transaction, you need to understand what protections apply to you and which don't. You need to understand what your obligations are and what the potential bad consequences should be. You need to think through the risks. You need to think about your leverage. You need to think about interconnections within the crypto world. And so I hope that people will take some of these lessons and use them for good.
That's a really amazing point. And I was going to ask you, if you had any advice for Web3 founders, what would it be? But I think I just heard my answer there, which particularly, you know, there is this sort of trust me, bro mentality. And I think culturally, there has to be some responsibility on the founders themselves as a collective to, if you see something, say something, mm-hmm. right? And to sort of discourage that activity, because at the end of the day, the collective is penalized. Whether it's just by perspective or whether it is by, you know, enforcements that may be harmful to the collective as itself. And secondly, the point is that there has always been this narrative that there are, quote unquote, no regulations, at least initially that regulations were unclear, but there are tons of laws and regulations that any Web3 founder has to pay attention to, in addition to this whole idea of a digital asset, a cryptocurrency, or a token. And we saw that in terms of money laundering, in terms of Banking Secrecy Act and other jurisdictions, there are loads of regulations that you have to be keen about and to understand, not just focusing on the digital asset piece.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. It's a very complicated world, complicated regulatory world.
Very complicated. And so many lawyers, I mean, we have a few lawyers that are listening on the live now, and they are very interested in this. What would you suggest to a lawyer who is looking to beef up their regulatory knowledge or to further dip their toe into financial regulation, what they should do to prepare?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question, because it sort of points to the fact that it's really hard to jump into this space and say, I'm going to be a crypto lawyer or Web3 lawyer without having that broader framework and understanding. And so I think some of the most, one of the most helpful ways to sort of get your arms around things is to have a really solid understanding of traditional financial regulation. And that's a big area. You know, you just mentioned money laundering. So that's one side of things, but that's very different from bank regulation, which is very different from securities regulation. And then you've got federal and state, and you've got international. I mean, you're not working in the US, you're trying to keep an eye on what's happening in the US, but also trying to keep an eye on the rest of the world. There's just a lot there. And so I think it's good to know what you don't know, and then be really honest with your clients too about what you don't know. But this is one of the challenges of an area like this. And I think, again, I go back to saying regulators, I think, bear some responsibility for not engaging with lawyers and others in the field to try to figure out the areas where some guidance would be helpful, or, you know, explaining how traditional rules apply in a space would be helpful. But I think, you know, it's just a lot of work. I guess that's my message, is it's a lot of work, and don't pretend to know things you don't know.
And
there are no shortcuts, right?
There are no shortcuts. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the very exciting news that happened a week ago, so just a few days ago, in terms of the Bitcoin spot ETF approval. Can you tell me a bit your thoughts about that? I did read your opinion and your comments there, but can you just give us a bit of background now about looking forward? What do you think this means for the industry?
Well, it certainly was. I mean, it was something that everyone had been waiting for so many years that it was nice to see it finally happen. And my reason for saying it's nice to see it finally happen is not that I'm saying people, you know, I'm not giving you an opinion on whether or not you should buy these particular Bitcoin exchange traded products or any particular product. That's not the role of a regulator. But I think what I was happy to see is that people had really persevered in pushing back against the SEC and coming back in and saying, no, we really want to put one of these products out, while the SEC had been putting obstacle after obstacle in the way of these products. And obstacles that really are not consistent with the framework that we've applied to similar products in the past. And again, it bears repeating. The SEC, when it approves a product like this to trade, is not weighing in on the merits of the product. And what I think was underlying some of our resistance for so many years to these products was merit-based. And that concerns me, right? You need to apply the same rules as you do elsewhere. And a court, an important court decision came out last year that said, look, we think you're not treating similar products the same way. And so that is arbitrary and capricious, and you can't do that. And so that court decision certainly was the push for these products to get out. We approved multiple products on the same day. And so I think that you know, we'll see whether people want these products or not. Obviously, some people have bought them already, but we'll see whether they last over time, and that's for the market to decide. But I do think that once we've acknowledged that the criteria that we use to approve these products, that those criteria work, then presumably they'll work for other similar products in the future.
Absolutely. And particularly for you, and up until 2025 and beyond, we'd love to continue to see the great work that you do and to hear from you and to really learn in terms of how things are shaping up. So as always, Commissioner Peirce, thank you so much for joining the show.
Well, Jamelia, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Thank you. Have a great day.
The conversation with Commissioner Peirce further confirmed my thoughts about how challenging it is to regulate a new technology. In addition to the challenge of understanding what the technology is, how it works, how it operates, you have the challenge of understanding how the market will react to it and how consumers or customers will be impacted by any new technology. What I took away from this conversation is that there are multiple challenges that regulators face. And one that's not often present or brought up in conversation is the challenge of creating a regulatory framework in a political environment. And as lawyers, as founders, as entrepreneurs, people who operate in this space, I think it makes sense to appreciate all of the complexities that we're all faced with. In this space, nothing is black and white. Literally nothing is cut and dry. And that's why the show is called Barely Legal in Web3, is because you may think that certain issues are straightforward. You may think that there is just one right approach to solving a problem, but in reality, there isn't. And as I look at other countries that have moved ahead and have rolled out regulatory frameworks for digital assets and virtual assets, when I first saw that happen, I thought, wow, this is great. Why can't the US do this? But these countries now are also struggling with the implementation of those new frameworks and with teaching new companies and entrepreneurs how to comply. They're faced with a different challenge, which is a bottleneck of applicants that want to come in, a wave of people that want to create and innovate in that particular country. And the regulator now has a difficult task of reviewing hundreds of applications with imperfect information. That sort of pressure of performing, there really is no right or wrong answer in this, guys. I just think that there are different interests. And if your interest is to innovate freely and quickly and in the way that suits an entrepreneurial spirit, then yes, of course, you'd prefer transparent regulations, and even some would prefer much less regulation. But if your interest is to protect consumers fully and to the highest extent possible so that consumers are not impacted adversely to a new technology or a financial product, then you'd probably be more for regulation, more strict regulations, and preventing certain products from getting to market. And so the question becomes, what is your role and where do you stand? I don't have an answer for you guys. I just pose the question. I think it's very interesting. And one thing that you'll notice about this show is that we're moving towards having more of these kinds of discussions. Discussions that are in the gray area. We want to talk about all different perspectives that play a role in this very complex and challenging environment. It's not just Web3, all emerging technology. We'll have discussions about artificial intelligence with innovators in that space, and really founders that are using different types of technology as their product. If you look at our YouTube channel, we're having more discussions with founders in Dubai, and we'll be looking at other markets too. So really, the purpose of this show is to give you the information so that you can make the decision, so that you can decide what is really going on and where do I stand? That's the question I leave with you today. Where do you stand on all of these issues? While you think about it, stay safe out there in those crypto streets and take care. Talk to you next time.